This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Even as the war with Iraq continues, the battle over who will govern that country afterwards is joined. In fact, it's a struggle that's been underway for the better part of the past year. There are plenty of groups vying for power and a lot of agendas. Few dispute that the first phase in post-Saddam Iraq will be dominated by the military, the U.S. and the British military, as soldiers and Marines establish control throughout the country. And then a retired U.S. general will lead an interim government to enable the provision of emergency food and water and medical assistance and the reestablishment of civil authority in Baghdad. But after that, it's a great deal less clear. There are dozens of disparate Iraqi exile groups who want to assume a leadership role in their country's reconstruction. There will also be new leaders who emerge from inside Iraq and leaders of the various clans and tribes and ethnic groups and religious groups. Who gets control? When? Who decides? The length and the scope of a U.S. post-war role is a major point of contention, and a critical area of dispute is also the role of the United Nations. French President Jacques Chirac, for example, said today the U.N. must have sole authority over the reconstruction of Iraq. At a meeting in Northern Ireland, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair tried to smooth out their disagreements on these issues. Here's President Bush.
Rebuilding of Iraq will require the support and expertise of the international community. We're committed to working with international institutions, including the United Nations, which will have a vital role to play in this task. This work, when the war is finished, will not be easy, but we're going to see it through.
When he was pressed on what having a vital role really means, President Bush responded that the UN will provide humanitarian aid and will support the temporary authority, but he assured the Iraqi people they would be the ones to pick the interim leadership.
It is a cynical world that says it's impossible for the Iraqis to run themselves. It is a cynical world which condemns Iraq to failure. We refuse to accept that. We believe in that the Iraqi people are capable, talented, and will be successful in running their own government.
This hour, we'll be talking about the post-war government of Iraq. Shortly, we'll hear from a prominent member of one of the Iraqi opposition groups hoping to play a leadership role. But first, NPR's Mike Schuster joins us from Kuwait City to bring us up to date on what's happening at the political level. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Neil.
We just heard a couple of clips there of President Bush. What do we know about the U.S. plans for a provisional interim government inside Iraq?
Well, they're actually not calling it a government, Neil. They're calling it a provisional administration, and they're emphasizing that that will be different than the government that they believe Iraqis will eventually set up. But there is a retired American general named Jay Garner who reports to General Tommy Franks, who reports, of course, to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. And he has brought, so far, a couple of hundred American specialists who are set to go into Iraq once the war is over. And, in fact, I think a few of them have already gone into Iraq in the southeastern port of Umm Qasr. And they're going to approach this from three ways. They're going to focus on humanitarian aid first, then reconstruction, and civil administration. And they've divided the country into three zones, the northern, the central, and the southern, and they will be three civil administrators or area coordinators, I think that they'll call them, who will be Americans, who will be the top administrators for those regions. And then they're also planning to appoint Americans to each of, they say, 23 Iraqi ministries. And they expect this process to go some 6 months after the war is over, in effect, to get Iraq back on its feet, to solve any humanitarian problems there are, to begin reconstruction, and to assume some of the roles of government. But they also expect to put in process some kind of procedures for Iraqis to decide what kind of government they want, what kind of procedures there will be, and eventually to elect the government. And it's that stage, the Iraqi stage, that's far vaguer than the civil administration side of things initially.
Well, let's stay with the civil administration side just for a moment. There are reports of a big struggle over basically who got to appoint all of these interim administrators, these Americans, and whether that would they would be to the pleasure of the Secretary of Defense or to the pleasure of the Secretary of State.
That's right. There were big arguments between the State Department and the Defense Department. And it seems that the Defense Department won this argument, and one of the elements of the argument was that perhaps this is a process that should be internationalized, not necessarily dominated by the United States and American figures. And I think some inclination on the part of some in the State Department to take this to the UN, because the UN has some experience in these areas in the aftermath of conflicts in trying to get governments back on their feet. But the Bush administration doesn't have a great deal of faith in that process and wanted to control it more. And it seems that the Defense Department has prevailed. Although the head of this civil administration, retired General Jay Garner, has been expected every day this week so far to give a press conference and to begin to explain to the public what it is that he and his and the others will do, but they've kept putting off this press conference because there are all these issues between the State Department and Defense Department, between the United States and Great Britain, and with the UN that seem unresolved.
Mm-hmm. Now, what role under the plan, as you understand it, the early administration under General Garner, what role would the UN play?
I don't think it's specified. There's a lot of talk about a UN role or cooperation with the UN, and there's a belief among some in the Bush administration that the agencies of the United Nations can play a helpful role, like, for instance, in humanitarian aid, delivering humanitarian aid to Iraq, or possibly the United Nations Development Fund in development program in helping in reconstruction. But my sense of it is that the Bush administration doesn't want the UN to play the central role of creating a civil administration. That's reserved for the United States.
Then there is, let's go to the reconstruction phase, and there is controversy there as well, that the United States is apparently already letting out contracts for some aspects of this reconstruction of Iraq, and not only is doing it, some people think that should be the United Nations role, but doing it to the exclusion of other countries' companies, including those of ally Britain.
And especially of other nations that opposed the U.S. War plans in the Security Council, such as Germany, Russia, and France. There are a lot of controversies about this because the money that will pay those contracts will come from the oil for food deal, essentially from the U.N.-sponsored deal that allowed Iraq to export oil and use the revenues to pay for humanitarian aid and other and the rehabilitation of the Iraqi economy. And in fact, those revenues will be used by the United States in whatever initial reconstruction efforts it will pursue in Iraq. So there is already a UN and an international side to this, and that's why some nations are unhappy that the Bush administration appears to want to reserve most of the contracts for American companies.
Okay, now let's get on to the transitional phase where this interim administration headed by General Garner would turn over to some kind of Iraqi government, and you say he wants to do it within 6 months?
Yeah, they're talking about it's actually at a higher level than General Garner. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz said over the weekend that he imagined that within a six-month period of time they would get this political process going, and that they don't particularly want this American-dominated civil administration to remain much longer than that. But just what kind of process would get underway, what political process to get the Iraqis involved in creating their own government, is still very vague. They haven't suggested ideas about that publicly. My guess is that they have plenty of ideas, but they just haven't talked about them yet.
And which Iraqis is, I guess, more to the point, and who gets to choose which Iraqis get to form the core of this administrative group?
It's a very important question, and there's already been a development about it. The Pentagon, for quite some time, has favored the Iraqi National Congress, which is a prominent Iraqi opposition group, but not the only one by a long shot. And over the weekend, there was a report that the U.S. Air Force flew in some 700 members of the Iraqi National Congress into Nasiriyah, along with their head, Ahmed Shalabi, who has already begun to issue issue press releases, begun to some degree to act like a government. So there already is one element of the Iraqi opposition that seems to have been favored by the United States and is already in Iraq with U.S. help. But it's the whole Iraqi opposition is a very varied group with lots of other organizations and representatives from all the various cultural and faith aspects of Iraq. And how the Iraqi National Congress, favored by the Pentagon, will be able to work with all those other groups is also a big question.
And the most pervasive political group inside Iraq up until now, of course, has been the Ba'ath Party. They were responsible, all their members were responsible for civil administration. Is there an idea that Iraq must be de-Ba'athicized the way Germany was de-Nazified, or are some of the lower levels of those Ba'ath Party members going to be kept around to keep the bureaucracy running?
You know, Neil, I think both. The answer to that is yes and yes. The Bush administration has been talking about de-Ba'athification for quite some time. But already in the South, Basra is an interesting example. Today, the British said that a prominent tribal leader in the Basra area to come forward and said that he would try to reconstitute some kind of civil administration in Basra. And after some long talks with the British, they essentially gave him the go-ahead. And he told them that there are some people in the Ba'ath Party, the civil administration who were in the Ba'ath Party, who should be allowed to continue to function in their positions in order to prevent the kind of chaos that's already taking place in the streets of Basra. There was looting and rioting today, and essentially no law and order, and there are not enough British troops to maintain law and order there. There was enough British troops to oust the Iraqi regulars, but not enough, essentially, to impose a civil administration. And so I think that, like many nations in situations like this in the aftermath of war, there are people who are civil servants and civil administrators that may have been connected to a vilified political party that will have to take up their jobs again.
And there has to be a fairly, as you were talking about, looting and rioting in Basra. There are reports elsewhere in Iraq as well. One of the urgent needs is to get a police force up, and this is something for which armies are ill-equipped.
Completely, and the British admit that. Today, the British essentially said, we can't do that job. We hope that, in fact, the Iraqi police in Basra will reconstitute themselves and begin to assert law and order, and we hope that this tribal leader who might be able to begin to put in place some kind of civil administration by committee will do that. The British want the Iraqi police to be able to do that. On the other hand, they say, right now, no Iraqis are to carry weapons in the streets. So if there is the remnants of a police force, they're going to not be allowed to use arms in order to reassert law and order in Basra, and that might be a tall order.
And at what point, one of the words we continually have heard over the past months is democracy. At what point is it envisioned that Iraqis would pick their own leaders?
The Bush administration people say that they think that this will happen quickly, but we just don't know. There haven't been any specific proposals yet for something like the Loya Jirga that took place, the Grand Council in Afghanistan. Things are not the same here. Perhaps the British move to begin to allow a civil administration by committee to form very quickly might be a model for the rest of the country, because other than Basra, there is nowhere where this process could take place, because there's no other Iraqi city, as far as I know, that the British and the Americans believe are safe enough to begin the process. So Basra might, in the coming days, it might be a model as to how this may play out in the rest of the country.
NPR's Mike Schuster, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Neil.
Mike Schuster with us on the phone from Kuwait City. We're talking about who will be involved in governing and rebuilding Iraq when the war ends. After the break, we'll talk with Kanan Makia, a high-ranking member of an Iraqi opposition group, the Iraqi National Congress. Call us with your questions, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send email questions. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here on Talk of the Nation, we're discussing about who will be in charge of shaping Iraq's future after Saddam Hussein is removed from power. Joining us now from his office in New York is David Phillips. He's a senior fellow and deputy director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also been an advisor to the State Department on planning for post-war Iraq. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
First of all, the question about whether the new leadership of Iraq should arise from within that country or what role Iraqi exiles might play.
Actually, both have an important role to play. The Iraqi exiles have been partners of the United States for many years. They're known to us and very much familiar with democratic practices. They can help blaze the trail, but they mustn't get too far ahead of Iraqis in the country who haven't had the opportunity to participate in these future of Iraq meetings and whose voice is absolutely essential if we're ever going to achieve real democratization in the country.
And as I'm not sure if you were with us and listening when Mike Schuster was describing some of the tensions that underlie all of this policy, but among them, and he's certainly not the only one to report, tensions between the State Department and the Defense Department as to how to make these arrangements.
I think everybody recognizes that the Iraqi exiles have a key voice to play. The interagency debate has to do with how and when the consultation with Iraqis more broadly should occur. What's important to keep in mind is the need for legitimacy. And legitimacy can be derived by working with those Iraqis with whom we've collaborated in the past, but making sure that the circle is broadened to include other Iraqis in liberated parts of the country so that there's a nationwide consultation on the future shape of governance.
As you begin to see things that are actually happening on the ground, what do you see? I mean, for example, we were talking about the British who've spoken with a tribal leader about perhaps assuming that charge of a committee to perhaps help impose some sort of order in Basra. We've also seen a lot of Americans consulting with an Ayatollah about entering into sensitive areas of Karbala in central Iraq.
There are many tribal and religious leaders and political party figures with whom we've had limited contact to date. As more and more parts of Iraq are liberated, these figures are going to step to the fore. It's important that we establish contact with them and, wherever possible, identify ways of working collaboratively.
And make sure that their voices are included.
Their voices need to be heard. And because they are close to the local communities, their voices tend to represent the actual needs of Iraqis from around the country. If we listen carefully, we'll be guided effectively in dealing with Iraq's requirements post-war.
What about the issue of legitimacy? You mentioned it earlier. Iraq's post-war leaders will need legitimacy. Do you think that the people who have been inside the country and suffering along with their people will have more credibility to Iraqis than outsiders, people who've been in London or New York or various other places for many years, some of them?
This process needs to start with de-bathification. This process looks much like denazification after the Second World War. Iraqis who have been associated with the regime in any way or with the Ba'ath Party need to be prosecuted for their war crimes and held accountable. The fact of the matter is that any Iraqi that wanted to advance themselves or play any kind of leadership role in the country probably became a member of the Ba'ath Party. Not all those persons are guilty of war crimes, although many may certainly be. What's important is to identify Iraqis in the technocratic infrastructure with whom we can work to keep the electricity on and the trains running on time, and then move quickly into a democratization phase, starting with local government, so that there is a genuine participatory process around the country.
And how long do you think that this might take?
One of the key rules to recall from other nation-building experiences in the 1990s is not to set deadlines, but to measure your progress in milestones. The initial milestone will be to create a secure environment in Iraq, to stabilize the country, to deal with the initial humanitarian needs of the Iraqis. overlapping that phase will be a process of rebuilding and reconstruction, and overlapping with that second phase will be the country's democratic development, starting in the regions, and then those regional representatives constituting some form of a constitutional assembly, defining the authorities of the central government. Once that's done, you can hold national elections, and as soon as you have a national authority in place, that begins to trigger an exit strategy. I think we've heard from Bush administration officials that they want to stay as long as it takes, but not a day longer. That day will be triggered when there are elections and Iraqis in place who can carry the ball forward.
Well, in Afghanistan, the Loya Jirga process got underway fairly quickly, and a government with some legitimacy was established. Is that a model?
The bond process involving the Loya Jirga certainly is a model. There isn't an equivalent of a Loya Jirga in Iraq. My view is that you need to start by working in Iraq's regions. The problem with Iraq in the past has always been too much centralization of power. There are local leaders, Kurds in the north, and different political and religious and tribal figures around the country who already have authority. Those are the people that we need to turn to first, and then work from those relationships to develop some census mm-hmm. that determines where Iraqis are living, then hold elections. You need to go step by step, and there's a role for the international community as we move forward.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Tom now, who joins us on the line from San Jose in California.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Thank you. My comment does regard the Kurds in the north. The cliche is the Kurds have no friends but the mountains. And right now we have Turkey poised, ready to enter Iraqi Kurdistan at the slightest provocation. The Iranian government is holding meetings with Turkey and Syria to discuss their common Kurdish problem, and there's very little commitment on the part of the Arabic component of the Iraqi opposition to a Kurdish role. So today it seems that the only friends that the Kurds have, and that's very temporary, is the U.S. in the area. So my question is, do you believe that the U.S. will work to ensure the Kurds are represented in a new federal Iraq, or do you believe that the U.S. will abandon the Kurds once again, as they have in the past, for their concern for the larger regional powers?
David Phillips?
The Iraqi opposition, starting with the Salahuddin Conference in 1992, has always reiterated their support for a federal democratic republic in Iraq. The Kurds are prepared to forego their dream of independence if they're able to secure at least as much as they have now through a federal system of government. When we were negotiating with Turkey the terms of reference for basing U.S. troops and opening up a northern front, I was much more concerned about the U.S. failing to uphold the interests of Iraqi Kurds. What we've discovered since the beginning of military action is that our best friends in Iraq are the Iraqi Kurds. They've placed themselves under a U.S. command and are working hand in glove with U.S. special forces in the north. This enhances the likelihood that their interests will be secured in the future. It's my hope that the democratic experience of Iraqi Kurds over the past 10 years can serve as a model for democratization in the country more broadly.
Tom, thank you.
Well, I hope that's the case. I certainly hope that's the case. And the Kurds have a reason for skepticism.
That they do. Thanks for the phone call, Tom.
Goodbye.
Let's go get a question from Jim, who's with us from Chico, California.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I've got two questions. My first question is has to do with the function of government and providing for a healthcare system that provides for the people. And do you anticipate some sort of universal healthcare system for the impoverished people of Iraq following this war?
David Phillips, I think there was universal health care of some sort in Iraq before the war.
Iraqis are well-educated and highly skilled. They'll be able to develop a health care system that addresses the needs of Iraqis over the long term. In the immediate aftermath of war, the priority will be dealing with the emergency conditions that are resulting from the conflict. That's going to require close collaboration between the United States and the technocratic infrastructure that exists for healthcare in Iraq. There's also expertise in the UN system, in UNICEF for primary health care, in the World Health Organization for building the capacity of Iraq's health infrastructure. The UN, the U.S., and Iraqis have to work together to address the health needs of the Iraqi people.
Yes, and I've got one more question as well. The United States military claims that depleted uranium ordnance poses no health problem for either troops or civilians, and veterans groups say otherwise here in the United States, and I imagine people in Iraq maybe have some different feelings on that as well. Is there going to be a health care system set up that will address that problem in order to find out where the contamination sites are and then to treat whatever health problems that may occur from exposure to depleted uranium ordnance in the future?
If that exposure poses a health risk, there should be a system developed to assess the risk and treating persons that may have been exposed. I know, Jim, that there was a similar concern after the conflict in Kosovo, and there were international experts who were dispatched to Kosovo and parts of Serbia to assess the severity of the problem, and they determined that uranium in the ordnance did not pose an extraordinary health risk. Let's hope that that's the case in Iraq as well.
Jim, thanks very much.
Well answered.
Okay, bye-bye. Before we let you go, David Phillips, I wanted to get you a little bit clearer on what role you see for the United Nations in this. Would it be, as Jacques Chirac say, the United Nations should have the only power authorized to conduct the reconstruction of Iraq?
I think it's important to go step by step. The immediate needs of the Iraqis are humanitarian. Their requirements are going to be for relief, assistance, and protection. The UN humanitarian agencies have a lot of experience and extraordinary skill in dealing with humanitarian emergencies. The UN Security Council should set aside some of the petty partisanship that prevailed in the past, and they should authorize a special representative of the Secretary General to act as an emergency relief coordinator. Mobilizing the skills of the UN agencies to deal with the humanitarian needs is the first order of business. Based on how the UN performs there, I think we can look at follow-on roles for the UN, dealing with economic development, reconstruction, and as appropriate and based on their capabilities and the needs of Iraqis, the composition of some civilian administration so that the democratic development of the country can be completed.
David Phillips, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
David Phillips, a senior fellow and deputy director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was with us from his office in New York. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Kanan Makia, a leading member of the Iraqi National Congress, one of many Iraqi exile groups. He's also a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at Brandeis University, the author of books about Iraq, including Republic of Fear and Cruelty and Silence. And Professor Makia, always good to have you.
Same here. Thank you, Neil. Good to talk to you again.
You've been working with the U.S. government, particularly people at the Pentagon, to figure out who would be in charge of Iraq after the war is over. What would you like to see happen?
I'd like to see a very genuine and serious intent to develop democratic institutions. I'd like to see a de-ratification program resembling that that took place in Germany after World War II, the denazification of Germany. I'd like to see no members of the Ba'ath Party, senior members of the Ba'ath Party, or senior army officers in any way, shape, or form connected with the interim authority that the putting together, and I'd like to see a really serious attempt to bring about a constitutional structures and a rule of law based upon democratic ideas and ideals, not based upon the lowest common denominator of Arab politics, which unfortunately is the way some people tend to think inside the U.S. administration. It is important to try to aim high, not to aim low, and to get the results that we all want.
Would it be fair to say that what you're interested in is something that would be described as revolutionary and that what you're concerned about is something that would be described as status quo?
You're right about the latter. I'm definitely concerned about an attempt to essentially modify the existing regime, keep intact the social structures that have brought us such devastation inside Iraq and that have brought the Arab world such misery and pain. Autocratic regime of a more benign variety. That is what I'm worried about, and dressed up in the garb of democracy. What we're talking about is a deep structural change of Iraq, change that goes right into the structures of ideological structures of control. It involves laws about the kind of thinking that has dominated the Ba'ath Party. If the ideology of the Ba'ath Party that needs to be worked upon in the structures of education, of culture, and so on. It is a very massive overhaul of society and the polity, yes.
And one of the aspects of this, and there are many, but one of them is the idea of secularism, a perfect division between church and state.
Yes, I myself am a strong upholder of that idea. And mind you, Neil, the way I like to think about it is not that one is in conflict with religion, but rather that one allows religion to flourish in spiritual realms and so on outside of politics. Politics has the experience of politics and Islam has led to a degradation of Islam itself. So you might argue that for the sake of Islam itself, its cultural flourishing, its spiritual flourishment, it is necessary for it and its scholars and clerics to take it out of the realm of politics.
And we have to remember that though Iraq is largely Muslim, only largely Muslim, there are many other religious groups there, and of course there are many sects within Islam, two of the largest, of course, Shia and Sunni. We'll talk some more about some of your ideas to handle Iraq's ethnic difficulties, and what I guess everybody always refers to as the Kurdish question when these moments
right.
in history come up, and hope that Kanan Makiya can stay with us if your cell phone battery will hold up for us, and we'll come back after a short break, so stay with us. We're talking about the future of Iraq, the role of the U.S. administration, and what kind of Iraq should emerge. Should it be a technocratic society, and how much role should Iraqis have, and how quickly, in deciding their own future? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, an update on North Korea. On Thursday, the country's withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty becomes official. We'll look at how the international community is responding. A meeting is scheduled at the United Nations Security Council. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're talking about who will govern Iraq after the war. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And on the phone with us is Kanan Makiya, a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University, more to the point, a member of the Iraqi National Congress and closely aligned with Ahmed Chalabi. And I wanted to ask you another thing, Kanan, about the Iraq that you envision. I've read that one of the things you wanted to draw up is a federated state, and we've heard a lot about that with the different ethnic and religious groups inside Iraq, but one based on geographic rather than ethnic lines. Wouldn't that cause difficulties right off the bat?
You're right. That is an argument we've been making. By the way, not myself, but this is an argument that comes out of a long history of the Iraqi opposition. Federalism was voted on in the Kurdish parliament in 1992, was adopted by the Iraqi National Congress a month or two after that, and in every single conference of the Iraqi opposition. So virtually all Iraqis in opposition agree that they want a state that is constructed on what they call federalism. However, definitions of what that means vary, and there are really two major ones at play. One, an ethnic notion of federalism, namely just the Kurdish-Arab division of Iraq. That, by the way, not all Kurds call for. Only one of the parties of the Kurds calls for that. That, it seems to me, is a recipe for disaster. That federalism, first of all, is not just a solution to the Kurdish question. It's the solution to the over-centralized nature of the Iraqi state, which has resulted in disproportionate expenditure on the center, on Baghdad, and very weak and impoverished provinces, north and south of the country. So federalism is viewed by myself and by others as a solution to the whole problem of the Iraqi state. That is, from a most centralized state politically to a decentralized state, a state that in which the regions participate as much as the center. And so it is important to think of it not as a on ethnic basis, because that would simply exacerbate tensions in the country, but rather geographical divisions, and not just two divisions, but perhaps many divisions. The number, of course, is a technical thing which needs to be discussed. Now, in these regions, a preponderance of Kurds would dominate, and a preponderance maybe of Arabs of Shiite background in other regions, and so on and so forth. But there would also be Turkomans, there would also be Assyrians, and there would also be Arabs and Kurds mixed in all these provinces. After all, Baghdad alone has 1 million Kurds in it. So the thought is here that people and capital have to move freely. There have to be no boundaries between these provinces and regions, and that these regions are somehow entitled to a share of the national resource on a proportionate basis to their populations. But this would be something that's determined constitutionally, that's inscribed somehow in the way that the state is built from its very outset. I don't think necessarily there would be problems, because the solution I'm envisaging would actually lead to an improvement in the standard of living in the north and south of the country, and certainly does give the degree of autonomy that Kurds have wanted and are perfectly entitled to.
Well, we have 5 minutes to get some questions to you. Let's go to Tom, who comes to us from Minneapolis. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Related to a couple points that have already been brought up this hour, which are the de-bathification of Iraq and the wish of Britain that the civilian police force in Basra would reconstitute itself in order to take kind of control of that city. My question is, aren't the members of the civilian police force in Basra necessarily, or haven't they necessarily been members of the Ba'ath Party? And if so, isn't that rather problematic to wish for them to regain control?
Conan McKeon?
Sorry, I didn't get that. The members of the Ba'ath Party regained control in Basra?
No, he was asking about the urging of British officials that the police in Basra reconstitute themselves to put down the looting, and wouldn't most of those people be Ba'ath members?
Yes, that's the kind of problem we need to deal with. Of course, we're still in the middle of the war. We're not yet at the end of the beginning of process of reworking all these institutions. But I think the United States is committed, and I say this from my conversations with officials, is committed to a complete dismantling of the security structures of the police. I mean, your traffic police might be fine, and there is a natural temptation in a situation like this to rely on existing structures. One of the things that people like myself fear most of all is that temptation in these early stages. So of turning to the structures of control that have existed in the past. That is a temptation. I hope the United States, even if it takes advantage of it in the short term during the war itself, does not succumb to post the final collapse of this regime, because it is simply going to be impossible to build anything remotely like democracy or on the way to democracy if we keep the existing structures of repression and control that have been responsible for so many of the abuses of the past.
Tom, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Audrey, and Audrey's with us from Jackson, Wyoming.
Hi. I have a question about how a country like Iraq that hasn't been democratic for generations learn how to become democratic, especially when all of the surrounding countries don't have that same kind of government.
You know, that's what they used to say about Germany for years and years, that Germans could never be democratic, that somehow autocracy was built into the very nature of the German soul or spirit. You know, in fact, that some people even argued that the failure of the Weimar Republic was because Germans could not sustain a democracy. And all those, we know what happened to all those arguments post-war Germany. No population is, democracy is not something that belongs to some people and not others. And a country like Iraq does have the objective prerequisites for it, which are crucial, namely the resources, the human and financial, the infrastructure, the degree of development, and so on. So I think, and as for there being no example of democracy, Well, the real break with the past occurred in 1968 with this regime. We had various interludes. We had a parliament for many years. It wasn't perfect. It was, in fact, sometimes quite repressive. But it was a real parliamentary system. Individuals emerged from it, important characters who played important roles in Iraqi politics over the first two-thirds of the first half of the 20th century. So there is no reason to think that that past cannot be, in a sense, built upon and developed, obviously, far more. And that, more than anything else, what we have is a population sick and tired of ideological politics, that has tasted bitterly the cost of that in the shape of dictatorship. And that, believe me, 30 years of Abbas experience is a training ground for something else. Look at the Kurds, after all. They've had 10 years outside the Ba'athist system. What they have in northern Iraq may not be perfect, but it is the beginnings of a genuine experience. They have a parliament. They have 150 or so media outlets. The private the media is you could say anything you like in that part of the world. So you have a great improvement, and this is also a population that lived for decades and decades under the same undemocratic totalitarian system.
Audrey, thanks very much.
Can I quickly ask one more quickly?
Very quickly.
So how does this take 10 years of the United States being in there to try to make it kind of all come together?
Well, you know, the United States was not in northern Iraq for 10 years.
Yeah.
It was in there, I think, for 6 months.
Right.
The Kurds have done it pretty much on their own.
Okay.
That is part of Iraq.
Great, thanks.
Audrey, thanks very much. We appreciate it. And Kanan Makia, we appreciate your time taking the time with us, too. We know you were
trying to get to
our studio, and we'll let you know where it is next time.
I really tried. Thank you.
Good to talk with you again. Kanan Makia is a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University, the author of The Republic of Fear and Cruelty and Silence, and he is also a member of the Iraqi National Congress. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.